Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Oh, hi! If you're looking for another spooky and funny podcast to add to your rotation, check out Anything Bones, now part of the Podmoth Network.
Hey, Boneheads, I'm Sophie Schwartz.
And I'm Caitlin Hart.
And we are the hosts of Anything Bones, the podcast where we talk about bones and bone-related topics.
Soph, what are bone-related topics?
Thank you for asking, Caitlin. This can be anything from mausoleums to murderers, famous skeletons to cadaver dogs.
Bone churches, mummies, serial killers. You'll hear about them all.
And sometimes we have guests stop by and tell us their favorite bony tales.
Check out Anything Bones on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, or wherever your little heart desires.
We release new episodes every Saturday.
Bon voyage!
Hello, and welcome to Bad Acts Podcast. I'm your co-host, Aaron.
And I'm your host, Danielle.
Bad Acts is brought to you by the Podmoth Media Network. Check out Podmoth for more great podcasts. You can support the show and get over a year's worth of bonus episodes over at patreon.com/badactspod. Additionally, you get ad-free early episodes. There's a link in our show notes, and memberships start at just $1. You can also support the show for free by leaving us a positive review and telling a friend about us. Now, on to today's case. You may notice that I am still hosting the podcast episode this week. Danielle is still recovering from her illness. Her voice is still a little hoarse, but she's getting better.
I know, I can talk better, but I don't want to have a coughing fit and have to do a bunch of extra editing to get rid of all the coughs, although I'll probably have to do that a little bit.
Absolutely. So you guys are going to have to suffer through with me for another week, but rest assured, Danielle will be back to her full strength very soon and bringing you awesome true crime content.
Except for now that I know that Aaron is so good at this, I'm going to make him read more, because like, you have gotten some rave reviews from the listeners. I think they like you better than me.
Have I?
I've accepted this. You are amazing.
Well, I don't think I'm better than you, but all right, on to today's case. For this episode, we're drawing inspiration from our recent Caribbean cruise. We visited Belize for the first time and absolutely loved the country. We can't wait to go back for another visit. So today, we're going to the Central American country of Belize on the hunt for a horrifying serial murderer. Belize is a small country in the northern part of Central America, bordering Mexico and Guatemala. A little over 440,000 people live in Belize, and its population is multicultural. While most of Central America was colonized by the Spanish, Belize was actually an English territory until 1981. So English is technically the first language, even though they also speak Spanish.
It was very convenient. I know a lot of Spanish, and I was so excited to be able to use it. But I feel like everywhere that the cruises go, there's a lot of people that try to speak English with you anyway. But in Belize, we get there and I'm like, hola, or whatever. And that's their first language is English because of colonizing.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually didn't realize that there was any place in Central America that was English as their first language, you know, like that. So like, that was really pretty cool. And yeah, it was very interesting for me to learn about that history because I didn't know any of that.
We learned a lot of facts. You know, I'm sure you've noticed from the podcast, I love to learn about stuff, so I was super jazzed. We went to go see some Mayan ruins. For those of you who do not know this, I'm obsessed with Mayan ruins. And on the trip there, it took a while for us to drive there. We got to learn a lot of exciting Belizean facts.
That's right. We really did. It was very cool. Another fun fact, we learned on our trip that Guatemala wants to claim part of Belize, which is true. And the border dispute between the countries is currently before the International Court of Justice. Apparently, this land dispute goes back to the late 1700s when colonialism began in Central America.
Yeah, and also Guatemala clearly wants it so they can have ports on both sides of Central America. I mean, that's just me. I mean, I can look at a map and be like, okay, that's clearly what's up.
Yeah.
And we got to see Guatemala from the Mayan ruins because we'd climbed to the top. And it's only like a mile away, so you can see into Guatemala, which is pretty cool.
It is. It's very cool.
And it does seem like the people that we met in Belize wanted to remain not part of Guatemala, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, they were basically like, we're really hoping that England can help us stay away from Guatemala. And I was like, man, you know when like you're trying to like hang on to England, that there's like...
You're like, we don't like them, but also if y'all could not let us join Guatemala, that'd be chill.
I know, right? Yeah. I was like...
Queen Elizabeth is on their money, which was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Because like you're not expecting it, but then it's there. Like they're part of the Commonwealth, even though they are technically independent. They're like Australia and part of the Commonwealth.
Exactly, yep.
All right, so now that we've officially learned a lot of information about Belize, we're going to get started with the case part.
Absolutely. In the late 1990s, Belize found itself at the center of its own Jack the Ripper case. At the time, the country had only about 200,000 residents in the entire country, so it wasn't accustomed to this type of crime. It all started with the disappearance of a 13-year-old girl in September 1998. On September 8th, 1998, 13-year-old Sherilee Nicholas left for school like any other day. She attended Wesley Methodist Upper School and had just started the fifth grade. She lived on the south side of Belize City with her mom, June Gabrielle, and her three siblings. The family's neighborhood was one of the poorest in the city, but they were eking by. A chatty girl, Sherilee was a happy child who liked school. The oldest of her siblings, she also had a lot of responsibility. On her way out that morning, Sherilee said goodbye to her mother. It was the last time June saw her daughter alive. Later that day, June arrived home to find all of her children home but one. Sherilee, who normally got home first, never came home that day. A chill ran up June's spine because Sherilee never deviated from her routine. She hoped that Sherilee had just stayed late at school, so she gave them a call. However, Sherilee's teacher informed June that her daughter never showed up for school that day. Since Sherilee never skipped school, June knew something had happened to her little girl. For about a month, June searched for her daughter, and local news stations reported on the missing girl. What happened to Sherilee remained a mystery until October 9th, when a local contractor stumbled upon something horrible about 8 miles outside Belize City. Along a feeder road leading to the Western Highway, which is also called George Price Highway, he spotted the body of a girl lying in a ditch. This bastard. Man, people gotta stop leaving, like, it's just, that's messed up. That's really messed up. All right. When police arrived on the scene, they found a partially decomposed body floating in water. It matched Sherilee's description. Despite the state of her body, the medical examiner later determined that she died from stabbing wounds to the left side of her chest. Her killer stabbed her so many times that her arm was barely attached. Ugh, that's brutal. Additionally, she had knife wounds on her hands that suggested she'd fought back against her killer. She'd also been sexually assaulted. Despite her wounds, police asked her mother to identify her body. She confirmed that the little girl was her Sherilee, but her mother, June, noticed something weird. The clothes Sherilee was wearing didn't belong to her. The clothes belonged to another missing girl, 9-year-old Jay Blades. Jay Blades disappeared on October 7th, 2 days before that contractor found Sherilee's body. At first, the police suspected that Sherilee's body could belong to Jay because she was wearing Jay's clothing. However, both mothers were sure about the ID. June insisted that the body belonged to Sherilee, while Jay's mom was sure that her daughter was still out there somewhere. Unlike Sherilee, Jay had run away in the past. She'd first gone missing in July 1998, but turned up okay. She'd actually been a runaway that time. Then she disappeared again from September 25th to 29th in 1998. About 2 weeks after Sherilee vanished. When she reappeared, she told everyone that she'd been kidnapped, but no one believed her. Apparently, Jay had a reputation for making up stories, so everyone doubted what she said. At the same time, she did start acting differently after her return. No kidding. I mean, imagine if you've been kidnapped and nobody believed you. I'd act out too. I'd be like, fuck that, man. I'd be like, come on, I got kidnapped.
Yeah, one of the things that's really interesting to me about Jay is that they make a big deal about her being a prior runaway and that she made up stories, but she's literally 9.
Yeah.
She's a 9-year-old child, and that's not right. That's not normal. Like, this wasn't... I understand that, like, a lot of these kids are living in poverty and their life is different, but it's not that different. Like, their area, as we learned while we were over there, is very focused on education and is a very, like, anglicized society. Like, the English controlled it for so long that they basically set it up like an English city. So it's not normal for, like, a 9-year-old to just be dismissed like this. Like, that's still a little child.
Yeah, legit. Then she vanished again on October 7th, 1998. For 6 months, Jay's family wondered what happened to her. In the meantime, several other girls went missing. Jay was still missing in March 1999 when another girl disappeared. On the morning of March 22nd, 1999, 12-year-old Jackie Fern Malik was on the way to St. Ignatius School with her sister Delma and a schoolmate. The girls were running late that morning, so a neighbor offered them a ride. Later, Adelma said that the neighbor, who was a man named Michael Williams, that the girls knew, just gave her a bad vibe that morning. So she told her sister and their friend that she thought they should just walk like they normally would. All the girls made it to school that day, and Adelma thought everything was okay. That is, until lunch rolled around. In Belize, it's normal for schools and workplaces to close during the lunch hour so that families can share the meal together. So Adelma went to meet up with her sister Jackie to walk home together. However, she couldn't find her sister anywhere. When Adelma went to talk to Jackie's teacher, she learned something shocking. Jackie left class for recess earlier in the day and didn't come back. Panic started rising in Adelma's chest. She asked around about Jackie, and one of her classmates knew why she'd left class. According to the classmate, a man drove up during recess and asked to talk to Jackie. She'd gone out to speak to him, but didn't return. The classmate described this man as being dark, but couldn't provide much detail to help finding him. Immediately, Adelma realized something must be wrong, so she rushed home to alert their grandmother. Jackie was missing. They started looking for her that day. For 2 days, they searched for Jackie, hoping to find her okay. Sadly, their hopes were squashed on March 25th, 1999. That day, someone found Jackie's dismembered body off the same feeder road where they found Cherilee's body, just a few miles away from the spot where her killer left Cherilee. Jackie was face down in the water and missing her left arm. The medical examiner concluded that she died from stab wounds, but she'd also been run over by a car after the murder. Jesus Christ. This guy is a real piece of work.
Yeah.
Real piece of work. Jesus Christ. All right. Additionally, the medical examiner confirmed that Jackie's wounds looked very similar to Cherilee's wounds. After Jackie's murder, the citizens of Belize City were in an uproar. They were tired of girls going missing, and they had led citizen protests calling for the police to do their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, legit. Good for y'all, because that's some bullshit.
Like, yeah, it's just wild that it was taking them this long to get any kind of movement with how gruesome these murders were.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that the cops would be all over this.
Yeah, there was also like a side problem that was happening, because as I mentioned earlier, Belize was under English rule until 1981. So there was a lot of people, there were a lot of people who were trying to blame, like, the pulling away from colonialization for this. Like, man, the English had such a safe country going over in Belize, but now that the English aren't in charge anymore, look at all these dead kids. And I think that really held the investigation back a lot, just because there were people that were focusing more on, like, look how everything's falling apart, and less on trying to fix the problem.
Yeah, they're focused more on politics, on the people.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Legit. On the day of Jackie's funeral, kids held up signs calling for justice. Additionally, people started to ask why the government had a special police force to protect tourists but didn't do the same thing to help the nation's children. That's a good question. In response, the police took some action by enacting a curfew. All youths aged 17 and under had to stay home between the hours of 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. But I'm very curious, how is that supposed to help when Jackie went missing in the middle of the school day?
Exactly. That was like what I put in as like an editorial note, that basically these murdered girls were disappearing mostly on the way to school and Jackie at school. So how is the curfew going to protect them? Because they're going to be out still during the hours when they're most vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah, that makes no sense.
It's so stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, I appreciate that it was for all the children and not just girls, because a lot of times when people try this curfew nonsense, they're like, okay, ladies, let's stay in the house. Men, I mean, do what you got to do. They're out there. It's like, like, I mean, they don't really say it like that, but you know what I mean.
But they're like...
The implication. Like, I don't know, we can't really do anything about the rapes, but if you guys could just stay at the house, that would be really convenient for us.
Yeah. That's crazy. In addition to the curfew, police put a guard on the school playgrounds to protect the kids from abductors.
I would make fun of that, but, like, here in the U.S., we have so many school shootings that, like, we can't make fun of guards at school campuses.
Yeah, when it comes to school protection, the U.S. is way behind. Basically, the literal rest of the world.
So we can't make jokes.
Yeah. Shortly after Jackie's murder, police arrested someone, but only in her case. They arrested 41-year-old Michael Williams, the neighbor who offered the girls a ride that morning. At first, everyone believed that he must be the serial killer who took Cheryl Lee, Jay, and Jackie. In fact, Cheryl Lee's mom, June, says that the family knew Michael Williams and he'd given them rides in his car before. On at least one prior occasion, he even offered Cheryl Lee a ride by herself. However, there wasn't enough evidence to confirm his guilt, and he actually had a really great alibi. He was working that day in his job as a mechanic. Not only did his client see him, he'd actually been with a police officer around the time of Jackie's abduction.
Which sounds scandalous, but the police officer was his client, so it just so happened that the car he was fixing for a lot of the day was this police officer's car, and the police officer was there. So it just strengthened his alibi. Like, obviously the police can be corrupt, but in this case, it was definitely something that made it seem like he was less suspicious because of the fact that he was with this respectable guy in their society. However, he was arrested still, despite that.
Wow. You'd think that would be enough to get him not arrested? Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, maybe interviewed but not arrested, because you're right. That's a really strong alibi. You know, that he's with a cop who's, you know, whose words should, you know, carry a lot of weight.
Depending on the cop. But in this case, appears to be not corrupted.
Yes, absolutely.
But while he was in jail, something else happened that made him look very not suspicious.
Yes. There was another sign that Michael Williams wasn't the Belize Ripper. Another girl went missing while he was in custody. That girl was Erica Wills, whom we'll talk about in just a moment. In the end, the court exonerated him.
Yeah, and so after they looked at all this evidence, it became apparent that Williams was not the killer. But I will say that Jackie Malik's sister is still convinced that he might be the killer, which I understand, because it's like she needs someone to blame, and he just felt suspicious to her.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that. If you don't have like an actual answer, sometimes you latch on to the only thing you can that you have to latch on to.
Yeah.
You know, because like you say, you need some kind of answer to deal with something that horrible, I imagine.
Yeah, and one of the things that makes the murder seem so like connected is that in addition to being found at that same location, you've probably noticed that there's severe damages to their left arms for the most part.
Yeah.
So in addition, they had other wounds that were similar, but that was such a unique thing that it made the medical examiner more convinced that these murders were connected, because you have someone using the same locations, but also most killers don't do stuff to left arms. So it's like weird that he's doing that.
Yeah, it's like a weird signature almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. As all of this was happening, another horrible discovery sent the case into a tailspin. In June, someone stumbled upon a skull and a small pile of bones along the same feeder road where they discovered Jackie and Shara Lee. But the discovery only raised more questions. While initially authorities thought the bones belonged to Jay, they discovered Shara Lee's knapsack and school uniform with the remains. While we were in Belize, we actually found out that all the schools have uniforms and they're all very different. That means it's a lot easier to identify which school a child attends and who a uniform belongs to. At that point, investigators worried that June had misidentified Jay's body as Shara Lee, especially since they'd found Jay's clothes with those remains. The murder investigation was partially hampered by the lack of facilities in Belize. Unfortunately, authorities don't have access to a crime lab to test things like blood, bones, and semen for DNA, or to compare fibers recovered from crime scenes.
Or at least they didn't at the time, I should say. But in this case, they were relying a lot on visual identification. Like, yes, this girl looks like my daughter. Or like, these are the clothes my daughter was wearing. So they had not verified that these were the remains that they were being identified as. So at this point, they started to be like, maybe we should do that. Because we have these two girls that had each other's belongings. Maybe we misidentified their remains.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, especially if you haven't been able to get the DNA off of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In the initial cases, police simply didn't have the items tested. However, once it became clear that a serial killer was stalking the streets of Belize City, both the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.K.'s Scotland Yard both offered to help with the investigation. To get confirmation, investigators decided to exhume Shara Lee's grave to test her remains and get a DNA match. June vigorously opposed the exhumation because she was convinced the body belonged to her daughter. She told reporters that she believed that the same killer took both girls and deliberately switched their belongings to confuse the police. Despite her protest, the police went ahead with their plans to exhume Shara Lee. After taking a sample of Shara Lee's remains, they sent it off to the FBI for testing. Eventually, the FBI confirmed that the remains did indeed belong to Shara Lee, and the skull and bones found at the quarry with Shara Lee's belongings belonged to Jay. June was right. By that point, police were sure that the murders were connected based on the pathologist's report on all the girls. Although the girls went to different schools, police thought that they could have been targeted because they all came from homes managed by single mothers. Additionally, all of the girls had been seen with food or clothes that their families couldn't afford. After their disappearance, investigators suspected that they may have been accepting gifts from a man.
Yeah, and like, at this time, it was, and still in certain areas, there aren't as many jobs, and especially with having a single mother who had several kids to support, it was a lot harder for these moms to pay for things. I think one of them's job was like a street sweeper or something like that. I think that's what Shara Lee's mom did. I know she swept something. And so she didn't get paid very much money. Like, she'd work all day doing the sweeping, but she barely made any money. And so it just was really hard for them to support their families. So what ended up happening is kind of like what happens with like sex work, but a lot of younger girls were being tricked and groomed into these situations because guys would come up to them when they were like 13 and didn't have any food for lunch or something and be like, oh, hey, I have this extra apple. Do you want it? And like, a hungry child is a hungry child. So they would take the apple, and then the next, like, this would go on for a while and it would slowly escalate. And so once they started looking at that angle, they noticed that all of these girls had someone in their life notice that they had like food or clothes or something, like practical items that there was an explanation of where they had gotten it from. And it would be dismissed, like maybe they took an orange or maybe their friend gave it to them. But that is something that became suspicious later. I think it was Jay, the one that kept disappearing, that they're pretty sure that that's why she kept disappearing, was because she was frequently seen at school with like food that her family couldn't afford. And people were wondering where she was getting this food from, but nobody really looked into it. But that seems to be possible. It seems to be possible that she was getting it from a man who was grooming her, which is disgusting.
Yes, it is. As investigators worked to identify the remains of Shara Lee and Jay, they were also trying to find 9-year-old Erica Wills. On June 26, 1999, Erica woke up early and left to go to school. Afterwards, she was supposed to go stay with some relatives. When she didn't show up, no one worried about her, at least at first. Her family members all thought that they'd gotten their wires crossed. The relatives she was supposed to visit thought she was at home, while her mother believed she'd gone to visit their family members. For 3 days, no one realized that Erica was gone. By the time they started searching for her, the trail was already ice cold. For about 3 weeks, Erica's family scoured the streets looking for her. Unfortunately, she wouldn't be coming home. Then, on July 18, 1999, someone found skeletal remains in Gracie Rock Village, which is also a small village located about 20 miles outside of Belize City. The remains lay hidden behind a rock quarry. A flock of vultures circled nearby, and the bones showed signs of feeding. Authorities later confirmed that the skeletal remains belonged to Erica, and they also found a tuft of her hair, along with her favorite hair accessory, a bracelet, her clothing, and a tweed bird ring. Based on the accessories, her mother knew that the remains belonged to Erica.
I would just like to point out that the Tweety bird ring is like the saddest thing. Like, not the saddest part of all the story. It just like really hits how young these girls are and that they're wearing Tweety bird rings.
I know. That was really making me sad when I was reading about all of that, you know? Because it's just, I don't know, just seeing the innocence and the... just lost. It just really sucks. On Monday, July 26th, 1999, about 1,000 residents of Belize City gathered together to mourn the murdered girls in a candlelight vigil. For about 6 months, the Ripper lay in wait. Then, he came back for one final victim. On February 15th, 2000, 14-year-old Noemi Hernandez went out to run an errand. Like Jackie Malik, she went to St. Ignatius High School. She was last seen in the area of Mosul Street, but she never came home. Her family searched for her for over a week. Then, on February 24, 2000, a Belize Defense Force soldier spotted partially decomposed human remains on a sandy mound in the mouth of the Belize River. The mouth of the river is in Belize City, where it meets the Caribbean Sea. Authorities later identified the remains as being part of Noemi's body. She was partially submerged in water, with her head facing down. A pathologist determined that she had multiple stab wounds to her face and neck. She was also missing her left arm, some of her fingers, and her head. That is absolutely gruesome. Whoever this dude is an absolute psychopath and a fucking animal.
Yeah, like for reals.
I mean, this is absolutely just disgusting stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, just, I don't know how you can do that to anybody, much less a bunch of kids, you know? On March 15th, 2000, Dr. Mario Estrada Braun, who was the pathologist on the case, spoke about his findings. He said that the killer had first given the girls alcohol and drugs so he could gain control of them. Once he had them, the killer used surgical precision to cut them, with which Dr. Estrada Braun likened to torture. Legit. That's legit. That sounds exactly like torture. Yep. He believes that the killer has a medical background or at least access to surgical tools that he knows how to use well.
Yep, it tracks. But also, I would like to point out that it kind of seems like if this guy was grooming them and giving them like snacks and clothes and stuff, it wouldn't be hard for him to like give them a juice that's laced with alcohol or drugs on the mornings that he kidnapped them.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it gives him a very easy method to get,
or even put it in on something. Because he doesn't say what type of drugs. It just might be something you could put on, like, a piece of fruit.
Yeah, like you could put some kind of roofie or GHB or something in it.
It wouldn't be hard to do in the juice. Yeah. I mean, we did that case. I can't remember if it was on the main feed or in the Patreon, but where the lady killed the little boy at the school so that her kid could do better.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then she gave him some juice laced with things. Mm-hmm. Like, that is not a hard thing. And the kiddo drank all of it.
Yep. That's true. Mm-hmm. Noemi was the last of the Ripper's victims, but the killer's canonical five, weren't the only victims of murder during the year and a half the Ripper was active.
And I included this information because these murders are always brought up alongside the Ripper murders, because initially they thought that the killer might be traveling around the country killing people. So it's kind of something that has to be looked at and dismissed before you can really track like how the killer moved in the country.
During the time of the Ripper murders, three other girls were also murdered in Belize, but their cases were later excluded from the serial murders. Those girls included 15-year-old Samantha Gordon, 13-year-old Becky Gilhari, and 10-year-old Karen Cruz. Samantha's case was connected to the Ripper murders once it became clear that Belize had a serial killer on its hands. She disappeared from a village 8 miles north of Belize City called Ladyville. In that case, police were able to track down and convict a group of 4 men who attacked her. Becky Gilhari's death happened around the same time that Jay Blades disappeared, so the two cases were initially linked. However, Becky disappeared in northern Belize in Corozal town, and the police were quickly able to identify a suspect. A 22-year-old family friend named Robert Hill, who'd been seen with Becky just before her disappearance. The court later convicted him of Becky's murder.
And I should specify that it wasn't just that he'd been seen with her. He was actually the one who was, like, taking her out that day to do whatever they were supposed to be doing. So he was, like, the last one with her, and then was just like, no, I dropped her off, and then she must have disappeared. And the cops were like, okay. Yeah,
they were like, come on, be real.
Yeah, let's look into this guy.
Karen Cruz lived in a tiny village outside of Belize City called Orange Walk Town, putting her close to the Ripper murders. Plus, she disappeared in June 1999, around the time Erica Wills disappeared. However, she didn't disappear on the way to school or from her school. She actually vanished from her own front porch. Later, neighbors pointed to her uncle, 38-year-old Antonio Baeza, who lived in the house next door and had been stalking 10-year-old Karen. The court also convicted him of her murder.
Yeah.
Okay, this guy is stalking his 10-year-old niece?
Yeah.
What a piece of crap.
And apparently the entire neighborhood was aware of it, and they had been trying to intervene.
Wow.
Because he was, like, obsessed with his 10-year-old niece. And it just so happened that despite the fact that she did have people in her life that were trying to protect her, she was just outside her own freaking house, and since he lived next door, he just basically waited, and he just snatched her when nobody was looking.
That's messed up.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
Aside from Michael Williams, the mechanic exonerated of Jackie's murder, there has only been one other suspect mentioned in the Belize Ripper case. He's going to be familiar to all of you, Los Angeles serial killer, the Grim Sleeper, Lonnie David Franklin Jr. Franklin committed at least 10 murders in L.A. between 1984 and 2007, but he seemed to take a 14-year break between 1988 and 2002. He targeted black sex workers and mostly killed adult women. The reason why some suspect him of killing the Belize Ripper victims is because he has connections to Belize. His wife was from Belize, and one of the vans he used in one of his L.A. murders was later recovered in Belize.
Which seems very, very, very suspicious that he had a reason to be in Belize, but the van does seem, like, very, like, dun-dun-dun.
It does. I mean, it really does. I mean, I'm a little... It seems weird that the MO would be so different.
Yeah, that's something that I had actually kind of included in my notes, because all of the Belize Ripper victims were young black girls, but he did kill adult women. He only killed one teenager, and that teenager wasn't obviously a teenager. She was working as a sex worker at the time.
Yeah.
So that part really stood out to me as weird. There are a lot of people that think that he is the Belizean Ripper, though, because these murders all occurred during the Grim Sleeper's inactive years. And for those of you who don't know, that's where his nickname comes from. He murdered a bunch of women in the 80s. And then stopped and then started again after 14 years of not killing. So these murders occurred during the inactive years. So normally you don't have serial killers take a break. There are people who argue maybe that's because he was doing this or other killings in other places.
Yeah.
And so it looks like he took a break, but maybe in reality he was, you know, killing others. And I do have a problem with the whole switching from adults to children, but maybe he did that to throw people off. Like, maybe that was just like, maybe it was just easier. Maybe he always wanted to kill kids, but it was easier to kill sex workers in LA. And now that he's in Belize and it's super easy to just give food and candy to kids and lure them into your van, maybe that's why he made the switch.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly could be. And I mean, you know, if a serial killer's in the area and you're having serial murders, I mean, you know, it's easy to put those two things together, right?
Yeah, it's just, it's an interesting thing. The van is honestly the thing that seems the most suspicious to me, is that, like, the fact that it ended up there. I mean, that is pretty shocking. And I think that it is possible that it was just the targets were easy. Because, like, again, we know that some people target sex workers because they're easy to target and because the police don't usually work as hard to solve their crimes. And in this case, we have children living in poverty.
Yeah, who are also easy targets.
Yeah, and, yeah. And like, to the point that it was well known that there were kids who were being groomed by adult men who were just literally giving them food to eat because their family didn't have food.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you, that's such a low bar to lure someone by, like, just meeting their basic needs.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what happened.
Yeah. And it really sucks that that's possible to do that, you know?
Yeah, like, I personally don't think that he was the Belize Ripper, but I do see how it's possible. And Franklin did die already in San Quentin prison in March 2020. It's actually, I think, possible for us to know because I do think they had DNA in this case. So, I don't know. To me, I feel like if it was him, they might have already matched some of the DNA because the FBI has the DNA from the Belize Ripper murders. It's possible he didn't leave any on the victims, but I mean, they were found in water, so that may have washed it away.
That's true. Water can mess up the forensics of a case. Yeah,
like three of them were found in water, and then two of them were found as like skeletal remains. So that would be kind of hard.
That would be pretty hard, yeah, for sure. You know, you could also argue that he was just going after easy-to-target female victims, but there was a lot of poverty in Belize City around this time, like we mentioned, which would make it easy to find adult women who needed money too.
You know, not just kids, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then Franklin died at San Quentin Prison in March 2020. As of 2016, there was a $100,000 reward for information leading to a conviction in these cases. Belizean police believe that they're hunting a serial killer who targets schoolgirls. Over the years, tips have come into the city's Crime Stoppers line, but the police have been able to rule out all of the suspects they've identified. Still, investigators haven't given up hope, and there's a chance the case could be solved. A lot has changed since the murders occurred between September 1998 and February of 2000. In September 2022, Belizean police assembled a special cold case team to go back over the Belize Ripper murders. They'll be testing all of the DNA and forensic evidence to figure out if the killer can be identified. By the way, DNA testing would definitely have determined if the Grim Sleeper was a killer, since his DNA is in the system. So I guess we might know once and for all, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I hope so. Like, it just is depressing that this crime is unsolved. I think that's partially why they continue to refer to him as the Belize Ripper, because they're violent murders with five canonical victims, and but like extra murders that could have been attributed. And they are currently unsolved. But there's one other thing that I thought was weird that I'm sure some other people picked up on, since we have, like, pretty much everyone that listens to this is a true crime buff. But you may have noticed the first victim in this case was named Sherilyn Nicholas, but the actual Jack the Ripper first victim was named Mary Ann Nichols. And the names
that's
are so
a really
similar.
Name,
that's
yeah.
So freaky.
That is weird.
Right? Yeah. Nicholas and Nichols. It's almost the exact same name.
Yeah. I mean, it almost makes you wonder if there's somebody out there who wanted to kind of be like Jack the Ripper a little bit. Because I noticed something else in this case when they were talking about the medical training or the medical tools, you know, because that was something that Jack the Ripper is always suspected of having as well, you know. And it makes me wonder if somebody just read too many Jack the Ripper books and was like,
I'm going to go do it.
Yeah, like, I want to be like that. I don't know why that would be something you would aspire to, but people are crazy, as we have learned on this podcast.
Yeah. And it may just be that by grooming these children, he convinced himself that, like, they were like, they're not sex workers. They're sex abuse victims.
Yeah.
But since he's a disgusting pervert, if he was doing these things to these children, maybe he convinced himself that because they were accepting these items and he was creating this relationship with them, maybe he deluded himself into thinking that that was the same somehow. Yeah. Because they were so much easier targets than, I mean, like, on the one hand, yes, there's women living in poverty that are also easy targets, but it's a lot easier to overtake a child than it is to do an adult.
Yes, it is.
It's also possible that that was just what he was interested in because, again, a pervert.
Yeah.
So, because most normal, regular people don't even look at kids that way.
That's
so
right. Yeah.
The fact that he even was able to see a kid that way is alarming.
Yes, it is. No matter what the truth is, this person who did these murders is an absolutely disgusting animal, and I hope they find him,
mm-hmm.
if he's still alive, and put him in prison for the rest of his life.
Yep.
And if he is dead, I hope he rots in hell, even though, yep, I don't believe in hell.
Yeah, well, for this purposes, believe it or not, hell.
Hell, straight to hell.
Yeah, straight to hell.
Yes. Well, look, we hope that you enjoyed this case.
I mean, I always say that, and then I feel bad about it. We hope that you found this interesting.
Yes, we hope you found it interesting and a good case to listen to, you know, something that was, you know, educational or something that you took something good away from. I mean, obviously we don't hope that you just, like, enjoyed murder and gruesome crime. you know what I mean? Like, and we don't think any of you do, but we hope that you enjoy the experience of listening to us.
Yeah, and also, you know, if somehow there's people that have information, I mean, you never know. We actually, I've looked at our stats, and we have listeners in, like, 112 different countries. So it's possible that we have listeners in Belize,
mm-hmm.
especially because, again, English is their first language, so they'd all know what we were saying. So that's super, super cool.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and so it just makes me, like, you never know. You never know. And this person could be someone who travels, and they could be anywhere. So these are definitely murders that can be solved. And we know there's the special team that's looking into them. And we loved Belize.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yes, we did.
I cannot wait to go back. The country is gorgeous. There's so many interesting things to learn about. The food is delicious. The people are awesome. Like, 10 out of 10 with Belize again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Belize was wonderful. 10 out of 10, like you said.
Yeah. And also, the uniforms are so... The school uniform thing was really interesting to me. Because there's, like the way that schools work over there, and this is also why some of the kids wouldn't skip, is that they are kind of, like... There's a lot of private school vibes going. All the kids wear uniforms, and their parents have to help pay for school, even though it's, like, required. So the parents still have to pay something towards it, even though the government pays a lot of it. And so these kids are not going to just miss because, like, this is kind of an investment in their future, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely.
It's not. It's taken a lot more seriously.
Yeah, it's taken very seriously.
But yeah, as we were driving back to the cruise ship, we were passing by. A lot of the kids were getting out of school. And it was so interesting that, like, on the same block, you would see, like, 5 or 6 different uniforms. And some of them were, like, kids that were, like, the same age. But a lot of the schools are either religious or, like, different types of religious or not religious. So, like, if you're Catholic, you're probably going to go to a Catholic school. There was, like, Mennonite schools. I'm trying to remember. I know we passed at least one Jewish school. And because I have, like, video of that one. And then we passed a bunch of other schools, too. But
yeah, there's a lot of different diversity.
Yeah, there's so many different schools. So it's easy to have kids that are, like, in the same neighborhood that go to different schools.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, thank you for listening, and thank Aaron for taking over while I'm all hoarse. This episode probably is going to be coming out in, like, the middle of the week because of the fact that I'm trying to make up for the week that we had to miss. Also, I forgot to say this at the top of the show, but we have a very important surprise that some of you probably know about. I know our patrons do, but a year ago, I did an interview with See No Evil about the Jonathan Foster case, and that episode is out on Discovery Plus, and it aired on Investigation Discovery like a week and a half ago, I think. And it's called, I believe, Don't Answer the Door. I think it's called Don't Open the Door, I think it's what it's called. So if you would like to see me on that episode, I am there, mostly at the beginning.
Please check it out. It's awesome. It's a super big deal.
Yeah.
We
love it. We totally are, like, established, I guess, as a podcast. Okay. I'm credited as a journalist, which, to be fair, I did used to work for a paper, but, like, they recruited me for, you know, the podcast. They were like, hey, your podcast covered this. You're local. Do you want to do this episode? And I was like, yes. And I did, like, a several-hour interview at a hotel and learned a lot about the show See No Evil. So it's interesting to see other people's interviews because I'm like, hey, like, I know how they made it look like that because I was there in the room.
That's right.
It was interesting. So check that out, and I'll probably remind you guys a couple times because, you know, like...
It's a big deal.
It's cool. It's super cool. All right, peoples, we care about you. If you want to listen to more episodes, go to the Patreon, patreon.com/badaxpod. We would really appreciate it if you could support the show. And also go to our social medias at badaxpod. Email us at badaxpod@gmail.com. We are accepting emails at all times. And we have a website,
which is badaxpod.com. Go check that out. Listeners, we love you. Be safe until we talk again. Bye. Bye.